Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to New Books in Sexuality and Sex Work, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Stewart, a PhD researcher at the University of Kent. Today we will be talking to Vanessa Carlisle about her book titled Take Me With You. It's published by Running Wild Press. And welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thanks for having me.
It's an amazing book. And I wondered if you could... if you could tell us about you. I was reading the blurb on your book. You're a PhD, you're a death doula.
Yes, a death doula.
A dom. Tell me about you.
So this book, the protagonist of the book is a queer sex worker, and so am I. And so there are some aspects of the book that are drawn from lived experience, but it is fiction. It's a novel. And so I have been in various forms of sex work for 22 years. I've been organizing in Los Angeles for a little over 10 for various ways of doing sex worker rights and decriminalization, right? We live in this extremely difficult, criminalized situation here in the US and in California. And so my PhD dissertation was taking a look at the way sex workers are represented in literature. And one of the things that I had originally thought was that there would be a big difference between insider and outsider representations, like people who were looking in on sex work from the outside would say one thing, and people who were speaking about sex work from the inside would say something else. And to some extent, that is true, right? To some extent, that is true, depending on the context. But one thing that came up in my research that really surprised me was that there just aren't that many pieces of fiction that have a sex working protagonist that are written by an out-of-the-closet worker.
Yeah.
And I was doing a creative writing PhD, and so I really focused on fleshing out a main character who was a sex worker, but for whom that wasn't the tragedy of their life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not always the worst thing that ever happens. The thing that would have happened if you were a sex worker would be far worse than the actual sex work itself. I'm always really keen when I speak to other sort of like sex working academics, because I was talking to someone the other day and I've realized I've hustled in every single decade since the 1980s.
Nice.
Not continuously, but yeah, like sort of like different things. And I wondered how your sex working had played into your academia. What came first?
Yeah, what came first? Well, I started stripping in college, so I definitely was trying to change my life through education. And I went to a private college, and I couldn't really afford to be working as much as I was and getting the grades I wanted. So I was at a private school where other people were getting their tuition paid for the most part, and not having to work a lot of hours. And I couldn't afford it. So I was nannying. And it was like, you know, get up at 5:30 in the morning, get kids to school, then go to school myself, then go get them after. And it was just a grind. So I started stripping at 19 and realized I could support myself working, you know, a third of the hours wearing glitter. It seemed great. It worked for me really well. It was, you know, it was 1999. And it was a different era. And I was in Portland, Oregon, which has the most strip clubs per capita of any city in the US. And so a very normalized part of the culture there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then over the years, things changed for me. But definitely sex work and my academic work have been linked, because sex work has been a main way that I've been able to stay afloat as a student, and especially as a grad student and as a PhD student. Yeah. You know, because I've never come from a situation where I financially could rely on anyone. So yeah, sex work and academic success have definitely required each other in a certain way.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I've been talking about this all week to different people, and I really kind of like how your book picks up on this, because there's a perception within the academic literature that people go into sex work, stay for a while, leave, and then never return.
Mm-hmm.
Never any, you know, there might be an idea that people can maybe do different types of sex work. But I kind of like the way that your book describes that kind of slide between different forms of sex work, you know, and I really enjoyed that. And for me, that really differentiates the sort of type of writing that's done by someone who's got sex work experience and an ally. You know,
yeah,
those wise others that I think Becca talks about, yeah, they're only relatively wise, and it's that kind of the relationships that you have, the friends that you make, that kind of introduce you to other forms of sex work, that I really appreciated about this book, that really gave this book a real authentic ring, you know, and I really appreciated that. So
thank you.
How autobiographical is this book?
Thank you for asking. Well, my mother is alive, so it's not 100% autobiographical. And, you know, I would say I did a lot of research for this book. There are communities being depicted in this book that I'm not part of, that I spent time working in and interviewing in.
Okay.
So I did have a brief time in my life when I was sort of, you know, mostly living out of my car. So there's definitely like a realism for me to some of the financial struggle that you see in the book. That stuff is definitely born of some awarenesses and real experiences in my life. A lot of the sex working experiences are either kind of composites of my own, or, you know, of course I'm part of deep community and I was married, to somebody who had lived experience. So there's a lot of, sharing of stories that goes on in those communities. So I borrowed from a lot of people for this book. But one thing that I think is truly autobiographical, that is just part of the main character, is the sense that, you know, the categories that we use to describe ourselves are almost always unfulfilling. So my professor, Amy Bender, who is a great writer and teaches at University of Southern California, told me, "I love how this character has such a wide open libido." And I was like, yeah, that's me. I've had partners from across the gender spectrum. I've taken all kinds of different roles, and I moved into being a pro-dom kind of haphazardly, and because someone I admired was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are in the book. those are depicted in the book, right? And so I think that there's a lot of integrity to writing from your own sex work experience, and working in fiction starts sort of making that complex, because there's a number of characters in the book who are houseless, right? There's characters in the book who are incarcerated. And so there's experiences that I haven't had directly, but that I've had indirectly as an observer, as a person in a visiting room for a loved one, or as a person who spent some time working with an organization on Skid Row in Los Angeles. So I'm really trying to come from the perspective of, this is fiction, but I did my due diligence where I didn't have lived experience.
Okay. Just for the listener who may not have read this book yet, but is going to buy it obviously after they've heard this, can you give us a kind of outline of the story of the book?
Sure. So this book follows a main character named Kindred Powell through her childhood and adolescence and into her adulthood. She is a sex worker. She's a queer person. And she suffers a pretty devastating loss early in life. It happens early in the book, and I'm not ruining any plot by telling you that she loses her mother early in the book. Her father, she's raised by white mother and black father. Her father, who is black, is not her biological father. And so there's a lot of tension around her understanding of race and her understanding of privilege. She grows up quite poor, but she's learning about herself, and she's learning about things as she goes when her father gets incarcerated. So he becomes radicalized in prison, and the story sort of follows the tension of their relationship, and then also Kindred's emerging into autonomy as a grown person who falls in love with another sex worker, builds a family, builds a life, and then it all kind of gets shaken up when her father Carl goes missing.
Mm. Yeah, I kind of liked the interplay with Carl, because I was under the impression that actually Kindred had a really good insight into the sort of like the white privilege, even for someone who's experiencing poverty. And you describe poverty really, really well in this book.
Thank you.
I liked that kind of like scrabbling around for change to pay the meter whilst they're waiting for at the bail office. Yeah, there's lots of kind of like little references to poverty that were quite, actually, they really reminded me of what it was like to be poor. You know, it's not like I'm rich now, but I've forgotten certain things, like, you know, like how tiring carbohydrates get. You know, you talk about how bored she gets in noodles. Yeah, so then
right,
we can go get some pizza, but we've got $12. Yeah, it's like, and it's like, okay, you forget about that, don't you? You know, it's and that was really good. But she really catches on. She really like listens to her stepfather Carl, and it seems to be that her mother is the one that has an issue with the kind of the realization around white privilege, even when you're poor.
I mean, exactly. Yeah,
gets arrested and beaten up by the police. You know, she's like, well, what did you do to deserve it? Basically, you must have done something,
right? And there's all of these cringy moments with the mom, where you can feel she doesn't get it. She doesn't understand. She doesn't understand what's going on here. And she's very much in her daily life grind, right? She's working more than one job. Usually she's exhausted. She's one of these people who wouldn't understand the notion of privilege, you know, too easily, because she feels like her life is super hard. Yeah. And her whiteness not being the reason for her oppression would be very confusing for Kindred's mom. That's just like not stuff she ever gets a chance to talk with her about. But you do, I think, have exposure in the story to the ways in which white people from lower classes get very confused about privilege when they hear it, because of how difficult it is to see it in their daily lives. You know, it's obviously operating. I mean, one of them gets arrested and one of them doesn't, right? So it's obviously operating, but it's still very, very difficult for Kindred's mom to catch on. And Kindred is much sharper at that. She sees it a lot more quickly. And, you know, Carl is training her from very young to understand power in the world and to understand resistance. So she has a complicated relationship with it. So I think, yeah.
You drop authors into this, like you mentioned Angela Davis, you mentioned Paulo Ferrer. It's almost like that little breadcrumbs to educate your readers. I really appreciated that kind of that device that you used. I can imagine when I was reading it, because it's I've got mixed race kids who actually are really white, but a mixed race, and I imagined them reading this when they were a bit, you know, as late teenagers. You know, wanting them to kind of, you know, sort of follow that hint towards Angela Davis, towards Paulo Ferrer. I thought it was really good. I also really liked how you talked about, there were a couple of phrases that you used that really resonated with me. One was secrecy is power.
Yeah.
Really, like from a sex working point of view, that is really sort of that's really powerful. When you get to know what someone's secret is, it's not so much a blackmailing tool, but it's more of a kind of I know what it is that makes you tick. That's what kind of keeps people coming back, isn't it? Is that kind of that sort of like heterotopic space that you can build with someone when you're the one person that they confide in. And I really liked that. And there was quite a few things through this book that as a former sex worker myself really resonated with me. You know, that secrecy is power thing was really, that really blew me away. That was really good. I really liked that.
Thank you. Yeah.
The other thing I really liked as well is this phrase, caught the darkness. Caught the darkness.
So this is one of those conceits of fiction where the first time I heard that phrase, it was a Leonard Cohen song.
Okay.
And I wrote it back in time and wrote it into another scenario. I borrowed it. I borrowed it and I elaborated with it. And it's something that I think very well describes sort of in a way that's less clinical, right? An episodic depression that has a real malaise in it. And the idea is that, you know, somebody who's sort of gone wild on something, who's having an agitated experience usually can calm down. But someone who's caught the darkness needs help to get out. And that it's a place where if you're left alone, you know, you can get swallowed by it. You can get lost in it. You can stay there.
Yeah.
And because Kindred witnesses this, knows that it's a possibility, watches her mother go there, she spends a lot of her life fighting it, right? Sort of in this desperate way sometimes, just like I have to figure out how to stay alive.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff is quite personal. I mean, some of that is definitely about my own ways of thinking about mental health struggle and depression and the isolation that can come from some of these experiences, how hard it is to find communities where people really share, a sensibility about life. And I find that Caught the Darkness is a way for me to feel it, think it, and let it be poetic, let it be art as opposed to letting it be a clinical diagnosis that consumes me.
Yeah. And also as well, now that you mention it is a sort of a Leonard Cohen phrase, it would make sense when, you know, young couples do that, don't they? They kind of, you know, they latch onto a phrase that's particularly like relevant to you. You listen to songs, don't you, when you're the age that these people are. And, you know, you kind of talk about those things. It becomes, you know, you own that phrase. That really makes sense. Although, you know, it's quite funny as well, because I don't even know if it's almost like the darkness catches you.
Mm-hmm.
Continuously throughout this book, is especially around Carl and around Kindred, is an attempt not to be caught by the darkness. It's almost like, you know, the darkness catches the mother, but doesn't catch those two because of their efforts to avoid it. They can't avoid it. So you talk about Kindred living in a car when she's after her mother's died and Carl's in prison. And she tries really hard to put a distance between herself and the darkness. Yeah, so she talks a lot about sort of substance use and, you know, that sort of stuff. And she like, I really got that sense with these two survivors as they're constantly trying to move away from this kind of the early death that's on the heels of both of them.
Yes. Yes. And it's difficult when you've suffered something like that to connect with people who haven't. So forever forward, Kindred has to be careful how she talks about her life, right? Because the instant you tell someone, you know, my mom died when I was 17, now there's pity in the conversation. Now there's people being uncomfortable, right? And I gave Kindred a number of these things as a character. Sex work is one of these things for me, where every time I come out as a sex worker, now I have to navigate whatever the bullshit is that's going on the other person's end, you know? and, you know, queerness can be like that, although I'm grateful to be living in an era where that's less of a danger to me. Yeah. You know, kink can be like that. There's all of these things that when you speak with people about them, you know, if you don't know the people and you don't know the situation very well, coming out is always a risk to find out, you know, just what discomfort you'll be managing from the other side.
Yeah, it's quite interesting as well. Like, because I, you know, it's so funny when you say that about sort of like how you're going to manage other people's bullshit. Like, as soon as you admit to being a sex worker at any stage, you instantly like a gang of like sort of turfs trying to rescue you, you know, or send out food parcels or something. But it's really funny as well, because it's that, you know, like the poverty that they experience as a family, that she experiences as a young woman, a theme of really grinding poverty, that doesn't seem to attract that same sort of sympathy, does it?
Oh, that's such a good point. That's such a good point. No, especially not in the States. It's like we have this, you know, incredible prejudice against people who come from poverty. And so you're just considered to have been born into a situation that you should have been able to change. And if you can't get out of it, that's your own fault. You did something wrong. That's definitely the narrative we have. So it's like, I often think of stigma as being the twin faces of stigma are pity and disdain. Right. And so if pity's not operating, disdain might be.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a stigmatized situation, one of those things is probably going on, and sometimes both.
Yeah.
And so as far as being poor, yeah, it's disdain.
Yeah. And it's quite funny as well, because when you talk about one of her customers, I can't remember his name, and he's made money, and he emphasizes the fact that she is aware of the fact that he believes that you, like, money doesn't make you, you make money work for you. And then
so some people work for their money, and other people's money works for them.
That's it. That's the one. Yeah.
And that came directly out of the mouth of a client.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll show, I mean, we're on a podcast so people can't see it, but it was, I want to show you my strained neutral face that I have to make when clients say things like that, you know, where you're just like, interesting, you know, I'm gonna go feel very strong anti-capitalist feelings about that later.
Some people are lucky to have that choice.
Yes.
Now, I really picked up on this theme of poverty all the way through, because it's really funny that part of the book is set in Bushwick, because I spent a summer 2 years ago in Bushwick, and you talk about this kind of optional poverty that is, you know, I think you said, I think, what was it, sort of squalor and coconut water or something like that. And it's very, very true, isn't it? She's removed herself from a family situation after her mum's died and after Carl's gone to prison. And she's kind of like entered this kind of queer community where she gets some acceptance. But there's also that they're quite patronizing to her around her poverty, you know, they're quite patronizing to her. I wonder if that's because she comes from a much poorer background than they do. But it also really picked up on this class thing that I am aware of among sex workers, mm-hmm. you know, especially among activist groups.
Yes, yes. I think it's really difficult for us to face class shame. And I think the pain of classism is one of the darker, more unspoken areas. So sex worker organizers in the past few years have really had to face the way racism has operated in sex worker organizing, right? You can't not be working on that anymore. When I first started organizing, those conversations were really hard to have. They weren't happening. This is 10 years ago. And now they're happening. And it's really good to see. I'm sure they were happening in various forms the whole way along. But a lot of the spaces I was in, there was just a lot of, you know, sort of unconscious privilege happening. And that has changed. But when it comes to class and the intersections of race and class, I think our analysis is still in its sort of nascent stage. I think that sex worker organizers are still really struggling to figure out how not to be in the hierarchy, you know, looking down on people who do different forms of work. Feeling their own maybe pity for outdoor workers or people who are in more difficult situations, right? So it's really a mindset and a worldview to adopt to say someone who's in a situation that looks like it's really hard from my perspective, that person has survival strategies, resiliency strategies, and stuff going on that I don't know about that I have to respect from not knowing.
Yeah.
I have to respect it from my position of not knowing and to understand that class differences need to be gently acknowledged and respected at all times. I think that that's a really, really difficult thing to get a room full of people to do.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, totally. It was because I really smirked when she meets what becomes a later on a partner, Nautica. And Nautica totally dismisses her whole experience. It's just being like fundamentally abusive. No, you're doing it all wrong. You need to be doing it like this, you know. And don't tell, you know, if you're gonna tell people that you're doing full service sex work, don't call it that. Call it girlfriend experience or whatever, because you're gonna upset their sensibilities if you talk about your life, you know.
And yeah,
I really liked that. I've had this discussion before when I've been doing research with people who have gone, you know, because there's an issue here, isn't there, that certain types of sex worker get to speak for the majority of sex workers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, how much research goes on that goes to sex work activist groups for their contacts And I read sometimes, I'm sure we're hearing the same sex workers giving the same interviews over and over again, because most sex workers are activists.
Right.
And so the sort of more active, the more kind of like politically engaged tend to get the voice, don't they?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And they often are bullying towards sex workers who don't have all the right language or who aren't coming from the same perspective. The way you have to identify as a sex worker, like take it on as an identity to even be an activist, pushes out a ton of people who would rather not have that be a big part of their identity, right? And it's very attractive, I think, for white, more privileged workers, because it's a marginalization. And it's like, oh, good, I can name this thing. I can give it a name. I can step into an identity that's marginalized that actually makes sense for me with what I've been experiencing. But that's like a very particular scenario, very particular situation. And a lot of people with lived experience in the trades don't give a fuck about that whole process that white ladies are doing. So, it's like, how do you bridge some of those gaps in conversation? I mean, as from my perspective, my job is to, turn the light the other direction instead of saying, you know, the problem is the outside world with all of their stigma, which of course it is. I'm sort of turning the light back around and saying, okay, but within our communities, how are we treating each other? And how can we improve our own ability to listen to each other and to show up more fully for each other's experience?
Yeah. And it's because I've been thinking about this a lot over the last couple of days, because various things have happened in my life. And I was, it's quite interesting, isn't it, when we talk about sex work, because the stories that we get tend to be the stories of people that are in some way need to be in contact with an activist group, or they've engaged with some sort of gatekeeper in some way. Whereas if it wasn't Nautica's involvement with the sort of brothel that they work in, the domination sort of dungeon that they work in. I mean, you can have a career like that and never come into contact with the police and never come into contact with an activist group, because actually your career is not in any way problematic. You might meet some people you don't particularly like, but you're not particularly victimized by your work any more than you would be in any other service industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's silent voices of the people that kind of go through a career and don't really have any ag at all that we don't get, do we? We don't hear them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of very vocal DOMs who are doing a lot of activism in a way that has sort of an imagined camaraderie with other sex workers that those other sex workers may not actually feel with those DOMs. And that's a difficulty, right? That's a difficulty. But it is an interesting little gray area. To me, it's a very interesting area. When someone asked me recently, why do you feel comfortable telling people that you're a DOM publicly? Like, doesn't that put you at risk the same way that saying you're a full service sex worker does? And I said, it might, but from what I've seen, the cops are really not sure what to make of penetrative sex that is pegging. Like, they understand that if a vagina is penetrated, something bad has happened, but they have a hard time with the concept that a man getting his butthole penetrated by a DOM is somehow also victimizing the DOM. Like, they can't, like, all of the structures of victimization that we're trying to place onto sex work get really upended in the femdom scenario. They get twisted up, right? And that's, it's fun. It's fun, but of course also it's not, but it's just an interesting place to be thinking for me.
It's really funny, isn't it? Because it's like, we never talk about it. It's the same way we never talk about sort of sex work and clinics and stuff like that. It's like, but it's really funny, isn't it? It's like, if a vagina is not ejaculated in, even if it's covered with a condom, then it's not so bad. But if someone is coming, a woman is coming in some way, it, suddenly it becomes a lot worse. But even within the community, because, you know, I wonder if like DOMs are more articulate because there's not that exchange of seminal fluid. You're not coming into contact with seminal fluid. I mean, it might be flowing about, but you're not touching it. And I wonder if that gives them that distance to be able to speak. From that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just flashed to a talk that I give on sort of a sex work stigma 101 talk that I give in college classes a lot, where we name the stigma, we talk about it. And, you know, it's very disturbing to name the stigma because everyone knows it. Everyone has it at the ready. You know, it's the same 10 things on the board every time I do this. But every once in a while, someone will throw in a name that people call us that I you know, just gives me a little shiver. And one of them that I hear a lot is cum dumpster.
Yeah.
Right. This idea that you are the receptacle, you are a trash receptacle for the seminal fluid of your clients. And you can't call a dominatrix a cum dumpster. It just doesn't work because that's actually not what she's not like receiving fluid, right? You shouldn't call anyone that. But the idea that it's coming into contact with penises, coming into contact with, you know, the orgasm, the male orgasm, the cum itself, that's like part of the problem. I think that's a big deal. I think that's a major question for all of the rhetoric we've got going into policy and law enforcement. It's just like, are you actually just kind of grossed out by cum? Is that really what's going on? Because that feels basic to all of this stuff.
Yeah. And it feeds into those kind of middle, like Victorian discussions about diseased, odorous, like.
Yes.
It talks about diseased, odorous prostitute. And it's really funny as well, because I keep saying it's really funny. I'm going to stop doing it. I read one of the phrases again. There were these little hooks for me all the way through this book. Listening is like letting someone touch you.
And
I really like that because it made me think of DOMs. Now, I was getting this slight sense of superiority from Nautica because she doesn't actually, oh no, they don't touch me. You've been abused because this man has put his finger up your ass in a strip club. But actually, like, you know, DOMs, yeah, or role players, yeah, they can be the repository of some really unpleasant, like, societal stuff.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That notion that listening is like letting someone touch you. Thank you for pulling that phrase. I when I was working on this book a number of years ago, I was dating someone who was doing sound studies. And we had all of these beautiful, interesting conversations about how the senses work, and particularly how I have a sort of mild form of synesthesia where many sounds I experience as physical touch. So my skin responds to sounds in a certain way that I found out is not normal. and
I guess some people can say something and it goes straight to my stomach. I feel you.
So my sense of this is that, you know, because you can't selectively hear, because hearing is this constant sort of availability. If you are a hearing person, of course, right? This presumes that you have access to that sense, that you have a kind of generalized availability to sound in a way that being in a body amongst other bodies, you also have a sort of generalized availability where people can touch you. And this sense that things you hear, things that come into your body via your ears, they stick with you, they stay with you, they affect you in much the same way that touch can. And I do think that our vulnerability as sex workers is sometimes very misunderstood, because as a DOM, sure, this guy might be tied up and I might not be in physical, you know, in any physical danger, but the things that he has said, or the things that he wrote, or the things that come out of, you know, come out of the scene might still be quite troubling to me, or cause me harm. So yeah, I think that I think that expanding our understanding of how people can affect each other is worthwhile.
I think as well, and this is quite odd, but as a mother, right, I was more concerned about her being a dom, especially considering she's been through quite an early sort of traumatized sort of teenage year where she'd like lost her mother very early and then her dad had gone to prison. So she's in effect been orphaned. Yeah, very kind of like very raw. I kind of liked her dancing a little bit more removed. I like the fact that she was earning plenty of money, wasn't going to put a man shoving his thumb up her bottom. Right? But I liked the fact that she wasn't getting up close and personal with like these really quite, you know, quite sort of disturbed sometimes people, or at least controlling, because that's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing that we never talk about when we talk about domination work is, well, it's from the bottom up, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's still a service. Yeah. Yeah. It's still a service, which means that you still have the complexity of a client relationship happening no matter what.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's why I was a terrible dom. Like, I don't do safety words. If you're tied up, you're going to get what you're given.
Oh dear. I hear you though. I mean, her vulnerability is, she's quite resilient. She's very scrappy in a way, right? This character of Kindred, but she's also really vulnerable to things. She's curious. And so she'll just try stuff. And people like who have that are vulnerable to things going wrong. And, you know, I think that that's definitely part of what her girlfriend sees in her. Like her girlfriend Nautica loves her for this, like sort of admires it in her, but also is like, okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, like you also kind of, you need to have a little more grounded sense of what your boundaries are. Kindred struggles with her boundaries. And, you know, we don't use those words in the book necessarily too much, but that's definitely what she's doing. And that is something that felt very true to my experience, true to the experience of, you know, trying to find your way through sex work in the era before it was all being documented and you know, organized online, because this book ends in like 2012.
Yeah.
And so the era in which Kindred is finding these clients is not the era of 100 Instagram communities.
No.
She's doing a lot of it on her own.
But also as well, it's like, and I think what really came across for me in this book is the difference between how Kindred enters sex work and how Nautica, am I pronouncing her name right?
Yes.
Enters sex work. Now, for Kindred, like there's, she talks about, describes having sex for somewhere to sleep. Yeah, you know, like what we loosely term survival sex, although I'm
right.
And so there's more of a kind of like a sort of slide into sex work because of a lack of other options for her. So the boundaries are like a bit more blurred. Yeah, when mm-hmm. you know, where does the entrance come in if you're sleeping with someone for somewhere to live, and then they give you like $50 on top or something, you know. Whereas with Nautica, it's more of a choice. It's more of a
lifestyle choice.
So you can be boundaried when you've got options, but when your options aren't so, you haven't got that many options, you're kind of like, it's a kind of, you know, it's eat or, you know, it's have somewhere to sleep, or, you know, sleep in your car, like she does on numerous occasions. But then it's quite hard to be boundaried, isn't it?
Yes.
I get that kind of like, you know, I find Nautica's attitude to her quite patronizing.
I love that.
I just think Nautica's really patronizing.
It is. It's an interesting area for them, right? Like it, and I think that it is. I love that you're going after Nautica. She's like, yeah, she's a little bit untouchable, right? She's a little bit superior. She's a little bit untouchable. She's quite powerful. And also she has opinions about everything. And And Kindred, it sort of blossoms under that focus, like in the way that some submissives do, right? That being focused on actually helps her self-develop. But Nautica isn't sweet about it. And they disagree about Kindred's experience in a way that I think really illustrates not just how this happens internally to our communities, but how people who are not sex workers feel like they have a right to tell us what our experience is. So Nautica's a sex worker. So there's a little bit of like, you know, ownership feeling that she has. But at the same time, she's never done what Kindred's done. She has no idea what it feels like to be in those situations. And you can feel that it's not quite right for her to have an opinion about it.
Yeah.
Because Kindred is the one who should be able to say, this is what happened, this is what it means to me, and that's the story, you know? And that's a big part of my intervention, I think, in fiction. I'm just going to hold because there's a noisy car out there. That's part of my intervention in fiction is feeling like, you know, I am very tired of reading sex working characters who have easily classifiable experiences from the outside.
Yeah.
And I think having a character that says, yeah, I was 18, which is young, and this guy wanted to suck on my feet and that was weird, but it was also kind of nice and I didn't mind it. Like that story is so confusing to people that it's like, we need to be able to tell it. We need to be able to tell stories that have a kind of complexity around whether it was good for us or bad for us. And that's Nautica's function.
We talk about sort of like having sex for money. We talk about prostitution. We talk about sex, but we never mention the benefits of the money. Okay, somebody spending an awful lot of time on your feet. Kind of weird, kind of cool, money very good.
Yes.
You know, it's almost like this kind of like this idea of like something being traumatizing, sort of like, or, you know, because Nautica's really hot. Is it Nautica that sort of like tells her that she's been abused later?
Yes.
Nautica does this a lot, doesn't she? She's always telling her she's been abused. But it's almost like she doesn't seem to recognize the abuse of poverty.
Right.
How much more abusive is poverty than someone worshiping your feet? I mean, we can get into this whole sort of discussion about sort of like the power play of that man who was, you know, in a position of authority in her life, wanting to like worship her feet. But yeah, it's kind of like she can be very one-dimensional, can't she, Nautica?
She can. I think she can, but I also think that part of it is, you know, she's also coming from her own marginalization, from not being a white person, not, you know, having to be in the world in a way that she's had to struggle in her own way. And so, you know, her sense of self-respect and power and decisiveness is hard won. It's supposed to read as a little bit hard won. And so when she judges Kindred's experience, it's sort of in that way that, like, you know, you're looking at somebody who you know has a ton of potential and you wish that they would just live up to it.
Yeah.
And it has that quality of kind of tough love, family love, that at least that was the intention, was that relationship is quite sturdy and that their love for each other is, you know, maybe it has a little dependency built in because Kindred comes from all of this trauma. Maybe it has a little bit of bossiness built in because that's Nautica's personality, but that ultimately those things are sort of mitigated by how deeply they do care for each other and how well they take care of each other.
There's a lot of going on as well, isn't there? Like education in the ways of how you need to survive, survival living, you know, like, so, and I get that from two of the characters in this book. Carl does this for her beautifully from prison. And I think you captured that really well, because I come from a traveler background. A lot of our men go to prison. And so there is this attempt to parent from within prison. And he tries to do that. He really does. You know, he tries to get her to read. He tries to get her to engage. He does what he can do. He tries to educate from within the prison system. And it's the same with Nautica. She tries to educate her in the ways of life, the kind of, you know, the not so much the day-to-day struggle, but the kind of stuff that you need to get on a bit further. You know, that's mm-hmm. boundaries, that recognizing your own as your own selfhood. And she does that, you know, she does do that. I just think she's quite pussy.
Noted.
I think it's because she reminds me of my kids. Like, talk to me like that all the time. I liked as well, and I thought you did this really well, is you talked really well about the impact that criminal justice system has on the whole family when someone is incarcerated. You captured that really well.
Thank you.
Well done for that. Well done for that. The devastating effect that Carl's imprisonment has on Kindred's mother, the waiting for the phone calls, going to the prison. And what I really liked as well, and what you've done really well, and what I've seen people in my family experience, is how the prison criminalizes the families.
Right.
I've seen kids being searched going into prisons.
Mm-hmm.
Kids taking in drugs into prisons. It's prison officers. Let's not get it twisted. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And that was really, really well observed.
Thank you. Yeah, that the gender violence that occurs there too, right? Of you can't go in to visit with any part of your body showing that they decide shouldn't be shown. And if your curves are too visible, you have to change your clothes. I mean, that's part of the scene that where Kindred is trying to figure out, you know, do I have the right pants in my car for today? And I experienced that directly visiting a loved one in prison. I, you know, some of that is autobiographical in the sense that it's drawn from things that I've been through. And I do think that devastation and the way that, you know, you feel your own fear walking in to visit somebody, and you immediately feel guilty for feeling it because you're not the one who's incarcerated, and you shouldn't feel bad because you're the one from the outside. You know, there's all of this kind of, you know, complex, painful stuff that happens for families that, you know, we are rightfully focused on our incarcerated loved ones and freeing them. We are rightfully focused on that. But one of the main reasons why we need to do that is because of the impact that it sprawls out across families and communities. Yeah. So,
I mean, I come from a traveling sort of like background, and the devastation on our community by the prison experience is equal to the sort of like the Black community in America. And that sort of the devastation to a family of a man who then becomes institutionalized and can't reconnect in the way that Carl can't after he comes out is really, you know, you picked that up really well. I really, really, you know, I really got that. And it also really put her into context, you know. She might not have come as far as Nautica would probably feel comfortable with her coming, but when you see what a starting off point is, she's doing amazingly well.
Right.
She's doing amazingly well. And what I also get through all of this is there's a kind of, it's almost like the miseducation of Nautica, isn't it?
of Kindred.
Of Kindred, she's getting all this help from different people, but I get the impression she's also going to be passing through here as well soon. She's building up speed.
I love that. That's beautiful. Yeah, and it is, those impacts are things that, you know, I mean when I was working on the book, I wanted her to find him, right? And that desire is part of the larger story. So without going too much into the plot so that people can make their own way through the plot, I think that Carl ending up on Skid Row in the first place has everything to do with his incarceration and nothing to do with his work ethic or his intelligence or whatever, right? Like all of these things, all of these stigmatizing things people want to think about who ends up houseless. It's very clear that, you know, that Carl was discriminated against in the job market because of having a felony, right? So we have this kind of, it's almost like I had to be very careful not to make that too cliche. It's so common. Mm. And I was reading recently numbers about traveling communities, incarceration rates in traveling communities, and how similar they are.
Yeah.
Right. And that the incarceration rates are just as high in places where the overall incarceration rate is way lower than the US. So there's even a more, in some ways, there's an even more dramatic disparity for traveling communities because of how different that incarceration rate is versus the rest of the population of the area.
Yeah.
And when you have that going on, I mean, people who don't have incarceration as part of their family's experience have a very difficult time understanding the runaround, the 18 phone calls you have to make just to make sure you've got the visiting hours right on this particular day, the way that they lock them down without telling you you drive 2 hours to get there and now you can't see your loved one, the exorbitant charges for phone calls, right? Like, people who don't have contact with the system, when they hear about these things, they're like, what? They can't do that. And you're just like, yes, they can. Yeah. They do. It's a feature.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, like, obviously, I'm a criminologist by, like, sort of training. And when I say criminologist, I'm not CSI. I'm definitely NWA. Yeah. And it's like that whole industry is built around, like, sort of prisons, you know, that sort of the telephones that they have in there, the amount of money that they make from just, like, upping the charges. But also, as well, like, you get this real sense of the how trapped Carl is, because in most states, once you've been in prison, you lose your right to vote. So you can't change the system either. And it doesn't matter how hard you try and change yourself, you know, or at least your outward appearance, if the system is built against you. And it's, yeah, I just thought you did that really well. And you know what? I've really enjoyed this book. I read it twice. That's why, you know.
Oh, thank you. Wow.
I was late to our date because I read the book again. And it is really, really good. So tell us, there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you personally. What is a death doula?
Oh, yeah. A death doula is a person who provides non-medical support for dying people and their loved ones. So, you know, when you think about the role of a birth doula as a person who sees a laboring person through their birth experience, right, and who interfaces with medical, who helps coach people through the understanding of the stages of labor, right? That's the doula model is very similar. So a death doula is a person who has some experience with and training around the stages of the end of life, who can come to a family or a community of people around a person with either with a terminal diagnosis or at end stage of life, or even quite a bit before, to help make the plans, to help with understanding paperwork, to help with creating ritual and meaning and space for, you know, conversations that need to happen that are sometimes very difficult to have. So personally, my orientation as a death doula is mostly around creating meaningful connections and communication towards the end of life and helping people plan for their end of life so that they get to have the good death that they want as much as is possible. And it's something that means a lot to me. I was a caregiver and bore witness to my grandmother's death last year. And I had already done some death doula training because I had a friend who was dying of cancer about a year and a half ago. And I felt like, oh my God, I don't know anything and I need to help. And I realized that as a sex worker, I have all of this comfort with just the body. Like, I just don't have, you know, I don't have any difficulty dealing with bodies. And I also understand bodies in kind of extreme states, right? Bodies in altered states. I've helped people with their, you know, with their LSD trips. I've coached people through their panic attacks. Like, sex workers are sometimes in touch with very extreme states of the body.
Yeah.
And that death And the silence in the US around death is very similar to the taboo we have around talking about sex in a lot of ways. And so I saw all these parallels, all these overlaps, and I pursued a training program, and now it's part of what I do.
Yeah, I think that's quite, I liked that as well. I liked that about your resume, because I just think that we don't talk about this ever, about the role of sort of sex workers and the wisdom of sex workers. I mean, you know, I know there are certain types of like sex work that almost acts as a sort of like heterotopia, like a kind of space out of space.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever talks about the types of conversation we hear, because academia focuses, is entirely obsessed on the sex aspect of sex work. Totally obsessed. Totally.
And still quite prim and like unable to really talk about it though, right? Like obsessively focused without being calm.
Yeah, it's like, you can't have sex for money, but we're not going to talk about the sex thing. And we're definitely not going to talk about anything else that goes on around it. And it's, you know, and I just found that really interesting, because I had a similar experience with my grandmother, actually, who died a couple of years ago. And I know it was a great comfort to her because of how we, you know, I could just see what she needed. Sometimes it was as simple as like, you know what, you just need, you just need a Starbucks for a straw sometimes, yeah? Different taste, a different sensation. You need, you know what, you need something on your lips because you're looking parched. You know, it's almost like you could read between the words, because that's what we're trained to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also I am able to take people for their word in the moment, right? So however someone shows up is how they are, and it's how I'm dealing with them. And my grandmother had dementia. And so, you know, she was saying all kinds of wild things towards the end of her life. And I really enjoyed her. I was able to connect with her. I was able to spend time with her listening to music, spend time with her, you know, telling rambling, strange stories, because my training, my many years of being a sex worker have told me what it looks like to meet people where they're at in order to support whatever it is they're trying to do. And, you know, that sounds simple, but it's not. You know, I wish more teachers did it. I wish more therapists did it. You know, to come in without a particular agenda and to say, how are we today? And what support needs to happen? Like, that's just, that's an orientation that I learned as a sex worker that I've been able to transfer into my end of life care in a way that's been really meaningful. And, you know, I think it's also the way that, as far as I'm concerned, the hookers in my life are the most honest. Like, they will tell you, the hookers in my life will see what's happening, tell you what's happening, and take action on what's happening faster than anybody else. They're just like, oh, I see.
No, there is no coincidence that they come after us so hard. You don't try to oppress what you're not threatened by. And why wouldn't you be threatened by sex
working? Right.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Masters hate us because they can't be us.
Yeah.
So tell us, what else have you got planned? What's on your agenda? What have you got coming up in the future?
Oh, that's exciting. So Take Me With You, the novel, is available for pre-order. It'll be shipped June 1st. So I'm very excited about that.
Who's publishing?
I have an article that's forthcoming in the South Atlantic Quarterly. The title is Sex Work is Star-Shaped. And it's a piece about a lot of the issues we're talking about now, embodied knowledges, right? What it means to be people who are creating spaces for new knowledges about the world through these networks and experiences that aren't easily categorizable. So that's coming out, South Atlantic Quarterly. There's a special issue that's all about sex work. I'm very grateful to be part of it, edited by Heather Berg, her book Porn Work just came out.
Her work. She's all over.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's exciting. And then I'm also teaching a writing class that will be available. It's going to be a pre-recorded class so people can do it on their own time through Pulp, which is a little magazine I adore. They have a platform called Pulp Public School. So later on in June, that'll be posted. And it's a writing course that's really centered on, you know, getting at all your senses in your writing, remembering that most writers privilege the visual and have a very difficult time really getting at sensations in the body, right? So we've got cliches, we've got frog in the throat, we've got stomach dropping, we've got certain cliches about the body, but getting more creative, more sensitive to what the body is actually telling us and being able to put that on the page. So I'm excited for that class too.
That sounds awesome. Do you have a link to the Atlantic article?
The South Atlantic, I don't have a link for it yet because we're still in the proofing stage. But as soon as I have it, I'll send it to you and I can put the link for Take Me With You. I can give you the pre-sale link for that.
Yeah. And if you can, because for the listeners, I will pop it into the blog that comes along with this podcast. It's been an Great. Absolute pleasure. I really, really enjoyed your book. I really Okay. enjoyed your book. It was so nice.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
It was a really, really interesting read. It was a really good read. I recognized characters I've met in my own life. Mm. Lots of characters, especially Nautica, seem to me are a lot in different in different bodies. I really identified with Kindred. I've met Kindred several times in my life, you know. Yeah, you did a really, really good job. So
thank you.
Shameless plug at this point. Who are you? What's the name of the book?
Oh, thank you. My name's Vanessa Carlisle, and the novel is called Take Me With You, available from Running Wild Press.
Thank you so much. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent.